Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to introduce the co-chairs of Working Group 2, who have been the stewards of this entire activity, Dr. Martin Parry, Dr. Oswaldo Canziani, and there's Dr. Renata Christ, who's the secretary of the IPCC. Let me first apologize for keeping you waiting, but as you know, we've had a long session all through the night, and you know, at the end of this enormous effort, we have what we think is an excellent report. And it's it deals with a subject that I think is really at the core of everything to do with climate change, because the Working Group 2 report deals with impacts, adaptation, and vulnerability. And this is what determines responses that human beings and societies will make to counter this problem, to be able to manage this problem. I just wanted to mention the size of this effort. There are 174 lead authors who worked on this report. There were 222 contributing authors. There were 45 review editors. The report itself is printed, it's typed pages, 1,572 pages. And the summary for policymakers, which you'll be receiving very soon, essentially is a summary of this huge volume that's produced through the effort of so many distinguished scientists from all over the world. Why is this particular report of significance? Well, firstly, because it clearly assesses the impacts of climate change in different parts of the world. And this time, far beyond what we were able to achieve in the third assessment report of the IPCC, we have far greater regional detail. And these details cover things like the melting of glaciers in different parts of the world, projections on what the implications of that melting are going to be, sea level rise, which clearly threatens a large number of countries in the world, the small island states in particular, but also those that have large coastlines and in cases low coastlines. There are mega deltas that are particularly vulnerable, and those have been identified in this report. There are going to be impacts on agriculture. Those have been assessed and quantified, and all of this has important implications for food security. And there's a much larger dimension that I think the impacts of climate change bring to the fore in a very focused manner. And that's the equity dimensions of the problem. Is the poorest of the poor in the world, and this includes poor people even in prosperous societies, who are going to be the worst hit and who are the most vulnerable as far as the impacts of climate change are concerned. And I think this certainly requires attention, because people who are poor are least equipped to be able to adapt to the impacts of climate change. And therefore, in some sense, this does become a global responsibility, in my view. I will leave the details of the report to those who have led this effort, Dr. Martin Parry and Dr. Oswaldo Canziani, but I will be here for a while to answer any questions that you might have. And I'd like to end by thanking you for being here and apologizing once again for keeping you waiting so long, but you know, we've all been working through the night. I'm wearing the same clothes that I wore in the morning yesterday, and of course I haven't had a shave, as you might notice. So, anyway, thank you for being here.
Hello. We're now going to have a PowerPoint presentation by Martin Parry, one of the co-chairs of the working group.
This report is called Climate Change Impacts, Vulnerability, and Adaptation. Climate Change 2007. It's the second of three reports by the IPCC. As you probably know, Working Group 1 was approved a month ago in Paris. Some of you were probably there. This is Working Group 2 on impacts, and Working Group 3 is in Bangkok in a month's time. And we've just surfaced from 4 days and last night, and we have approval of our document, and we literally meet in an hour's time with clean copy of that. The heroes of this are the authors, not the bank managers like Dr. Kanziani and myself, but the troopers who've done it, the 200 or 300 scientists over about 5 years. I just want to show you some results from this. The report is published by Cambridge University Press in the summer. Hard copies of the summary for policymakers we approve in an hour's time, so unfortunately we can't give them to you now. But I'll give you some of the basics, if I may. I've got someone here to press the buttons. Andy here said to me, for goodness sake, apologize in advance, because the adrenaline's run out now, and we're sort of floating on our feet a little bit, so this will not be a polished presentation. Firstly, some real troopers have done some work, and they're in this room, by the way. Drs. Casassa from Chile, Rosenzweig from the Goddard Institute in New York City, and Caroli, also from the U.S., and they're here to answer questions, have done some work bringing together what we know about the impacts of observed climate change happening now. If you track through the IPCC, 5 years ago, it concluded that there was a, 10 years ago, a detectable anthropogenic effect on climate, 10 years ago. 5 years ago, Rosenzweig and others identified a discernible regional effect of climate change. That is, for example, an area like Europe, that warming was having an effect on insect movements, on phenology of plants, on water levels and so on in lakes. What they've done now is finally established that at the global level, there is an anthropogenic, a man-made climate signal coming through on plants, animals, water, and ice. This is the first time at the international level and for the IPCC that there has been confirmed this signal. We've read, of course, and you probably write a lot about pigeon flies over Trafalgar Square, one way rather than the other, must be climate change or something like that. But it's very difficult to put that information together. And this is what they've done. They've firstly confirmed that on all continents, there's a regional signal. Regional climate change is affecting animals, plants, and so on. And secondly, they've concluded that at the global level, this is doing the same. That's an important conclusion, really, because for the first time, we're no longer arm-waving with models. This might happen, right? This is what we call empirical information on the ground. We can measure it. Next slide. This is the sort of thing they've been looking at. The one line indicates is the climate getting warmer. This is in Western Europe. Another line indicates leaf unfolding of silver birch. And another line indicates leaf unfolding of the horse chestnut, as we call it. There's lots of these graphs, insect behavior, bird migration, dates of bird laying. But finally, they've all been put together into a global story. Next slide. This is the sort of thing that is common around the world, but this is the first time that statistically the case has been proven. 29,000 data sets this group used, and more than 90% of them are in the direction that would be expected for climate change. Here's a glacier high, glacier high in Bolivia. On the left-hand side, 1940, you can see the Skeeto. It was the highest skiing field in the Alps. 1982 on the top right, 1996, and the snowfield's gone now. Well, a lot of people were arguing this is, you know, just the regional issue, less snowfall, a precipitation issue, but conclusively now the IPCC, both one last month and two now, has put this into a world story. Next slide. And this is the sort of map they produce. It's very detailed, but it plots these 29,000 data sets all around the world. The great majority, because their observations depend on monitoring systems in Europe and North America, as you can see. So these are developed country, well-funded monitoring systems. But if you put these things together, there is a global picture. Next slide. Now let me talk briefly about future climate change that the other 18 of our 20 chapters were working on. Next, please. Firstly, we concluded that when we put all our impacts together, we can now begin to build a picture more systematically of what sort of impacts would occur for what amounts of warming. Now, here's a detailed table coming up, which we took a day and a half to get agreement on. But what it shows is that, can I walk over here and you can still hear me? As you go from 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 degrees above present, this is a global temperature. For the fields that we've been looking at, water, ecosystems, food, coasts, you can see the sort of impacts, thank you Osvaldo, that are coming through. The gobbledygook on the right is all the sources, don't worry about. So for water, increased water availability in the moist tropics, but in the low latitudes, can you read that writing or is it really too detailed? Thank you. Let me read out some of the things here. Increased water availability in the moist tropics and high latitudes, where it's already moist. We don't want more of it. And unfortunately, decreasing water availability, the second line, and drought in the semi-arid low latitudes. It's exactly what we don't want. It makes the world much less even, more inequitable. Ecosystems, up to 30% of species facing extinction with 2 to 3 degrees of warming. Corals, we know they're being bleached now. Widespread coral mortality by about 3 degrees. Can you, by the way, see those numbers? 3 degrees, and can you read coral mortality where I'm pointing? Just have to nod. Okay. Food supply. We knew, but now we know much more, how cereal productivity in low latitudes will tend to decrease, even with a small amount of warming. Starting at 1 degree, you see there's a tendency for a decrease already. Yeah, right. And for high latitudes, the problem areas in terms of emitters, yields likely to increase because a little bit of warmth doesn't do them any harm. But there is some point somewhere up here that Easterling and his colleagues, Agrivala, in this room, have found this turns down. There's a key point. Globally, we lost the line because our confidence level is too low. You put these two together, and somewhere around about here, 1 or 2 degrees, you get a global downturn in productivity from climate change. That's a sort of important point of inflection, I guess, that authors would call it in science terms. That's the sort of stuff we've started to put together. Now, why is that important? Because firstly, it shows as climate change ramps up, impacts will increase. But put it the other way around, and for the first time we can say, if you draw down climate change this way, 5, 4, 3, look at the impacts you avoid. 30% of global wetlands lost. The downturn of global productivity. Significant extinctions around the globe. A sort of instrument for the policymaker, a little sort of database. It's only a start, and there aren't many impacts there, but that's the sort of information base that we're working on. Next slide. Here are our conclusions about the most vulnerable ecosystem. Briefly, headlines. Coral reefs, sea ice regions, those ecosystems that are at the margins. Cold, tundra and boreal forests, mountain at the high end, and Mediterranean regions, those that are, these ecosystems or communities, and Fischling and Midgley, they're in this room probably as well, have done an incredible job making some up-to-date statements about these things. So that's marginal ecosystems. Secondly, low-lying coasts, again, places at the margin. Water resources in the mid-latitudes because of that previous line. Decreases in water resources in dry areas. Low-latitude agriculture, because any amount of warming is going to decrease yields there. That's exactly what we don't want, isn't it? We've got 500 million hungry people in the world today, according to the FAO. Those numbers are likely to increase as a result of climate change. And particularly, another vulnerability is human health in those areas where adaptive capacity is low, where there's malnutrition, poorly developed health, public health systems. And the next, corals are one of the issues, particularly affected by ocean temperature. But here's another new point. not reported yet in the IPCC and not yet widely reported in science. We've now begun to realize that increasing levels of CO2 in the atmosphere are absorbed into oceans, carbonic, is it, or carbolic acid, one of those two, making for ocean acidification, not the sort of thing that corals want, any shell-forming organism. So an additional impact now, just beginning to be reported in the science literature, are impacts on shell-forming ecosystems, mollusks and so on, in oceans. And next. Here is the sort of impacts mapped, which we've done, and Kunzewicz and Mata, who are in this room, from Poland and Venezuela, have been working on this, identifying not only the sorts of precipitation patterns, this is a distribution of runoff, in other words, the water that results both from precipitation, which isn't evaporated, the combination of the two, and have been plotting some of the sticking points, if you like, flooding, thinning of the freshwater lens in some islands, increase in pathogen load in polluted and heavy-laden precipitation and so on. Let me briefly mention the regions most affected. There's often difficulty at UN levels in picking out particular regions. We weren't able to list them like this, but I'm listing them for you. These are the things, the places we think are the tipping points regionally. The Arctic, because of high amounts of warming. Sub-Saharan Africa, because of drying. Small islands, because of their inherent sensitivity, lack of infrastructure, they're on their own. And Asian megadeltas, low-lying, in the path of typhoons and increased frequency of those, and billions of people. And next, thermohaline circulation. The three authors in this room, I see Steve Schneider here, I'm sure would be interested to answer questions for you. There has been a lot of talk about shutdown of the North Atlantic thermohaline circulation. Their conclusion is that, firstly, this is very unlikely, and even if it did, temperatures would probably continue to increase in Europe and North America because of the warming influence. So the shock horror stories you hear about Europe may freeze and the next ice age, this group and others in Working Group 1 have in a sense proved to be in very low probability. In the longer term, the issue may be different. And there may be important changes from that, effects of that in terms of marine ecosystems and fisheries and ocean CO2 uptake. And I think we're near the end now. Next slide, just click it on. And then there's the issue of extreme weather events. We've often talked about sort of incremental climate change. Now we've got some more information of how weather events may change, floods, droughts, the number of warm nights, the number of heat waves from Working Group 1, and are translating that into effects on impacts. For example, the number of people that are put at risk every year by increased heat waves. People living in corrugated iron roofs in summers where days are above 40 degrees centigrade is not much fun if you've got no access to cool places. And people die from heat stroke who perhaps didn't die before WHO is beginning to show. Now, this is not a result of anything like those conditions, corrugated iron roofs or people without the support. But you're well aware of this sort of event, which was extremely unlikely, one in 300 to 400 years, never occurred on the precipitation record or the thermometer record of those numbers of deaths in Paris in summer 2003, between a half and two-thirds of which the estimation is was due to climate change, and the rest variability peaked on top of that. Next slide. To all this, we've had a set of authors working on adaptation, and their conclusion is that for all the talk about mitigation, and there's a lot of talk in the Framework Convention, it's adaptation that is going to be necessary in the near term. Why? We've got the tools ready. There's lots of options in adaptation. We can put them in place now. Whereas mitigations, even if we could agree them, and it's taken 10 years to do very little, will take decades to have an effect. So mitigation may work in the long term, but in the near and medium term, by which I mean 10, 30, 40, 50 years, adaptation is going to be vital. And the sooner we get on with that, their conclusions are, the better. And I think finally we've got some headlines, Andy, you put up. Ah, right. They conclude that some adaptation is occurring now, but there are important barriers and limitations to this. The key tipping points are where climate change is exacerbated by those other things: poverty, marginality, impoverishment, low adaptive capacity. That this vulnerability depends not only on climate change, but the development pathways we take. In the IPCC 5 years ago, the Working Group 1 developed a set of 6 development pathways to look at high emissions and low emissions, right? Sustainable future, low emissions. High growth future, high emissions. Actually, what's more interesting to us is the populations in those. One goes down and one goes rapidly up. And these development pathways hugely affect the impacts. We can probably grow ourselves out of the problem if we wish to, on a highly sustainable, equitable world, if we could manage to do it, most unlikely, on the sort of what used to be called business as usual pathway at present, we're growing well into the problem. Mitigation can reduce, delay, or avoid the impacts, but it will take a good many years to have its effects, even when it's put in place. Well, I've talked long enough. Those are the sorts of things we've worked on. As I say, the heroes of all this are about 200 scientists who've worked for 5 years, and also my colleague Osvaldo Canziani from Argentina. And I guess it's your turn, Osvaldo. Thank you.